Hi. Good evening. Oh, this is magic. Hi, I'm Elaine Petruccelli, and on behalf of both Dominican University of California and Book Passage, I'm so happy to see you all here tonight because I'm a groupie for Marian Wright Edelman. But I have a few sort of housekeeping things to ask you. The first one is that ever popular, please turn off your cell phone and so that it doesn't bother you during the event. I'd also like to tell you that tonight's event is being broadcast worldwide on Penguin Radio. So if you would like to call a friend so that they could tune in, the web address is simple. It's radio.dominican.edu. But if you're going to call your friend, do it real quick before you turn on. And I know that many of you received a copy of The Sea Is So Wide and My Boat Is So Small with your admission, and thank you so much for that. As you're thinking about your children and your friends, I hope you will buy multiple copies. I have four children. I've already bought five books, one for me and one for each of them, because we're going to change the world. So I will now turn this over to Dr. Denise Lucy, and we will go on with the event. Thank you.
Approaching the lectern, Dr. Denise Lucy, broadcasting live on radio.dominican.edu.
You're also very studious. Must be the building and the space. Welcome to Dominican University of California. It's a pleasure to have you here this evening. My name is Denise Lucy. I'm a professor of business and leadership and the director of the Institute for Leadership Studies, which is a host of this evening's event. And it is a wonderful, inspiring evening that we have in store for you, because Marian Wright Edelman, lawyer, reformer, activist, educator, is here tonight to inspire all of us. She's going to speak about her book, The Sea Is So Wide and My Boat Is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation. I wanted to, though, before we begin and introduce Ms. Edelman, I wanted to just also recognize our fantastic partners for this evening. We have several. Of course, the Children's Defense Fund is a major partner. And we are so appreciative of their support and their participation. Another important partner is the Marin Education Fund. And I wanted to take a moment just to explain what is Marin Education Fund. Marin Education Fund is an organization here in Marin that believes that everyone should have a chance at college, irrespective of one's ethnicity or socioeconomic background or race. Everyone should have a chance at college, and it advocates for educational equity for everyone in our community. Dominican has a partnership with Marin Education Fund. Every summer, we host students who live here on our campus for 5 days, and we offer them the opportunity, through Marin Education Fund's great guidance, to learn how to apply to colleges, to help them assist with their college applications, to learn more about how to fund college, prepare for tests. It's a crucially important program, and we're so thankful to Marin Education Fund for everything that it does for our community. I want to thank the board members who are here tonight, our staff, Marin Education Fund, and President Kim Azuka for her leadership. Another important partnership, Book Passage. Everyone in Marin knows Book Passage, don't we? Yes. Yes. Let's thank Book Passage. Without Book Passage in our community, it would not be quite the same. And of course, now they are also in San Francisco, so please do tell your friends and patronize Book Passage and all those independent booksellers that bring such important community programs to our town. Elaine and Bill Petruccelli specifically, and Karen West, I want to thank you for your great support as always. Marin Magazine has joined our lecture series as a media sponsor, and without their support, we would not be able to get the word out to our community. So thank you so much, Marin Magazine, for giving us your time and support as well. Our academic partner tonight, the School of Education of Dominican University of California, the best education program in California, I must say. Our faculty are here this evening, some students, and also our dean, Ed Kujawa. Thank you, Ed, for your help. Now, speaking of an important partner, one of our most important and special alumni, this alumna is the Marin County Superintendent of Schools. Her name is Mary Jane Burke. She's a great friend to our campus, one of our former graduates, and is going to introduce to you our speaker.
If we don't stand up for children, then we don't stand for much. This is a quote from the speaker we are so privileged to hear this evening. She's actually striking in her ability to get to the heart of the matter, just like the incredible career and work of Marion Wright Edelman, a leader, perhaps the leader on what our nation must do to meet the needs of all of our children. She is a voice for all children. She draws on the experiences of her own childhood, one of five children, born to a mother and father who instilled in her the spirit and compassion for others. She draws on her own experience as a parent, a mother who raised three boys with her husband and who understands firsthand the dreams, the challenges, the hopes, the worries, the absolute joys that come with being a parent. And of course, she draws on the incredible experiences she has had during this incredible career. Her time at Spelman College and her legal education at Yale Law School. Her early advocacy for Head Start and other federal programs for children and families in poverty. In 1967, with Senator Robert Kennedy, on his now famous journey to Mississippi, where he was so very moved and called to act by the dire and impoverished conditions he saw related to the children and their families. Through her tireless advocacy, the Children's Defense Fund, which she founded in 1970, has grown into an organization that is recognized throughout the entire world. So much has been achieved, and yet I'm sure we will hear this evening about how much more we need to do. We, each and every one of us. Marion Wright Edelman's work has never been more important, and we are privileged to hear her speak this evening about her new book. While preparing for this evening, I learned that Marion Wright Edelman is actually named for another great American, Marian Anderson, the famed African-American opera star. In 1939, Miss Anderson was prevented from singing a concert in Washington's Constitution Hall because of one thing: the color of her skin. Led by Eleanor Roosevelt, another concert was organized on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. The image of Marian Anderson standing on the stage and singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" in front of 75,000 people is unforgettable. her voice strong, her message clear, her dignity moving and inspiring. Tonight, with a different Marian, gratefully we can say, her voice is strong, her message is clear, and her dignity moves and inspires us. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our incredible speaker. Welcome.
Children's movement, which we're going to have, is going to depend on us.
I have a voice.
Well, the Children's Defense Fund is for all children. It's the most exciting program of hope and independence for parents and children. Every movement needs a school for training and skills. And Haley Farm is our movement building home. It's our place where we vision what we want to see for children and then gain the skills and the courage to go out and build it. And we've been training another generation of young people, which is the most exciting thing.
I need training.
I will take the necessary steps.
I am ready.
I am ready to read. I am ready to read.
I am ready to read.
I am ready.
The Children's Defense Fund's parent organization was born in the middle of the Poor People's Campaign. And it was very clear that children don't come in pieces. We have to address the needs of the whole child.
I need someone to care about me.
To care about me.
And it was wonderful to have 9,000 children marching to talk about health care for every child and be empowered and see a 7-year-old standing up on Capitol Hill.
I recently learned about the issue of health care in America, and it made me very sad.
A healthy child is a child who is alive, excited about life, safe, vibrant, is in good health, has health care.
I need health care.
Health care.
Health care.
Is excited about learning, is excited about their future, can see a future and see how they will be able to move beyond today to tomorrow.
I have a future.
I have a future.
A bright future.
I will make a difference tomorrow.
They are confident, they feel loved, and they feel respected.
I will not be abused or neglected.
I will not be abused
or neglected.
I will not go away.
There's something inside of them that's so strong that nobody can touch.
I can speak for myself.
I have a voice.
A voice.
A voice.
A voice.
I have a voice.
You're doing a voice.
I have a voice.
What we're trying to do is to build empowered children, competent children, loved and loving children, and healthy children who are ready to go out and seize and lead the world.
I am not a number.
I am not
a number.
I am not a statistic.
I am not a statistic.
You're not solving the world.
I am not a number.
There are a number of laws that would not be on the books. I think that CDF's reports and lobbying and public education campaigns and organizing would not have made it possible. I'm very proud of the fact that all children go to school. We tend to forget that children were the frontline soldiers in the civil rights movement. It was little Ruby Bridges, 6 years old, who went through the mobs. The Children's Defense Fund is committed to changing the odds and creating a level playing field for every child.
Who can help me stay out of trouble?
Who can help me stay out of trouble?
Stay out of trouble.
When the bus will end up in prison.
I need a plan to succeed.
I need a plan to succeed now.
To succeed now.
I need a chance.
I need a chance.
A chance.
I need a chance.
Not a handout.
Not a handout.
Not a handout.
I have the potential to be great.
I have the potential to be great.
We're trying to pass the torch so that the movement can sustain itself. It doesn't do any good to do new policies if they're not strong servant leaders out there who are going to implement them. And so we're trying to change the paradigm in America, as it is the children of the world who are going to determine the future. I think that this is the most important work, and it's been a privilege to be a part of it.
Today, tomorrow, together.
I have a future.
Thank you.
future, and if we don't invest in them today, I'm convinced that they will be our moral and economic Achilles heel. I think that we're all in the middle of an economic downturn, indeed an economic debacle, but it's going to pale in comparison to our continued neglect and failure to educate and raise a new generation of children who can compete in the new century. So our message is it is the right thing to do to invest in our children. It is the cost-effective thing to invest in our children, but it is absolutely the necessary thing to do is invest in our children if we are going to remain world leaders. So there's nothing more important that any of us can be doing than seeing that all our children can go into the new century educated and healthy and connected to community and family. And it's a privilege to be here tonight with people who are committed to achieving that same goal. I thank you for that lovely introduction, Mary Jane. Thank the Dean of School of Education. I thank Elaine Patricelli and her wonderful bookstore. I thank Denise. You have been very welcoming, and I can feel the hospitality in this place, and I'm delighted to be in this wonderful university. We have pushed so many of our children into the tumultuous sea of life. In small and leaky boats without survival gear and compass, I hope they will forgive us, and I hope that God will forgive us. I hope we will be all moved to give all of our children the anchors of faith and love, the rudders of purpose and hope, the sails of health and education, and the paddles of family and community to keep them safe and strong when life's sea gets rough. In this first decade of a new century, our nation and world, I believe, have veered alarmingly off track, become less safe, less just, more precarious, and balkanized. The gap between rich and poor in the United States and in the world are the highest ever recorded. A cloud of nuclear annihilation hangs over every child and human being. Global warming threatens our Earth, and before and after 9/11, we have come too slowly to recognize the oneness of our poorest world, where disease, pollution, climate change, and terrorism know no borders and require collaborative solutions. And the militarism, the excessive materialism, the racism, and the poverty that Dr. Martin Luther King warned could lead to our national and global destruction still run rampant. Violence stalks children and all of us everywhere. The pollution of our air, water, food, and earth, and the coarsening discourse of our airwaves, internet, and media leave virtually no child untouched. Moral, community, and family values are frayed, and millions of children in all race and income groups are growing up without hope and a sense of moral purpose. Adult hypocrisy in too many homes, schools, communities, religious institutions, and private and public sector policies is confusing and leading many children astray as they do what we adults do rather than what we say. And I believe it's time for us adults to get our act together and stop dropping the ball of responsibility for our children's well-being and future. In the United States, we have a child and youth problem because we have a profound adult problem. Children, all children, need positive and authentic adult role models and voices challenging our cultural addictions to power, money, celebrity, violence, alcohol, drugs, as well as obsessive materialism and individualism. They need to see leaders developing a concept of enough for all, and fairer policies as the rich get richer, as children get poorer. All children need adults to teach them how to struggle with complexity, to think through the short and long-term consequences of their actions, to bounce back from life's inevitable failures, to learn how not to be lonely when alone, to think, ask the right questions, solve problems, sort out and synthesize reams of information, make informed judgments, and take effective action, to sacrifice and to, in order to build a fairer and safer world, and to listen to the sound of the genuine, which, according to the Gospels and prophets, of every great faith dwells within each of us. While 13 million underprivileged children in the richest nation on earth are growing up in indefensible poverty without the most basic necessities of life and a fair chance to envisage a better future, millions of overprivileged children are growing up infected with the affluenza virus, the spiritual poverty of having too much that is worth too little. Given every material thing they desire, cell phones, iPods, fancy cars, and the latest trendy fashions, while living in big houses in well-to-do neighborhoods, many lack sufficient parental and community attention, limit setting, spiritual guidance, and moral example. They roam around in peer herds from one place to another, trying out drugs and alcohol and tobacco and loveless sex and race and gay bashing, seeking entertainment and thrills, with increasingly high thresholds for the bizarre and violent, just like many of the children left behind in the ghettos and barrios. These lost, adrift children in all income groups and racial groups are desperately crying out for attention, for direction, and protection from parents and other responsible adults. I wrote this book because I don't want my grandchildren, who have radicalized me all over again, or any child growing up in a rich nation that thinks it can imprison its way out of the glaring inequities in our society and suck poor children of color into a pipeline to prison. I don't want them growing up with leaders infected with a sense of entitlement, who think we can bully our way to world leadership through hubris and military might rather than moral right. I don't want them growing up in a nation that continues to marginalize and mistreat millions of children and people of all ages because of their color, income, disability, gender, faith, or ethnicity. I don't want them growing up in a country that gives lip service to equal opportunity while neglecting the poor and sick and the orphan and the stranger that our faith traditions enjoin us to help. And I don't want them growing up in a culture that objectifies and degrades any of our daughters, or where any of our sons believe that manhood comes from seeking superiority over women and that fatherhood ends with conception. And I don't want them growing up believing that prophets are more important than people, that missiles are more important than mothers, that bombs are more important than babies, that sacrifice is a dirty word and nonviolence is for softies. I know that we can change these problems, which we have let ourselves drift into. And while I do share a lot of sobering realities in this book, this is not a doom and gloom book. It is a wake up, get off your duff, and stand up and reclaim our children, families, community, moral values, and our nation, and let's do it together. It's a call to conscience and to action and to leadership for all who seek to build and leave the world we hold in trust for the next generations better than those than we found it. And I know what can happen. We've all lived. I grew up in a period which I feel so lucky about, to have seen the transformation of our nation and world in ways that we could not have believed possible in a lifetime. Who would have thought that few mothers and fathers and poor group of band of lawyers could challenge legal racial apartheid in our country and bring crumbling down centuries-old walls of racial segregation? And we saw the courageous witness of a small minority of children like Little Ruby Bridges and the Little Rock Nine and others who were the frontline soldiers. And they did all these things because they wanted a decent education, and the parents because they wanted a better life for their children. And all those citizens who built a civil rights movement to end segregation in American life deserve our thanks, but they also deserve our emulation to finish the job of putting the social and economic underpinnings beneath those political and civil rights. And civil rights without a job or a means of eating, without decent housing, without an education, without health care, is hollow. And Dr. King understood that at his death as he called for a poor people's campaign. We've seen the fall of the Berlin Wall in our lifetime, symbolizing the end of the Cold War, and we've seen the breakup of the Soviet Union and communism crumble across Eastern Europe, and we watched in awe as Nelson Mandela walked out of jail after 27 years, offering a kind hand of reconciliation to his former jailers. And you and I now have the opportunity in 2008 and the awesome responsibility to compose and to play the next movement of America's Symphony of Freedom and Justice, to forge a nation and communities where more good people outplan and outmobilize less good people, where more people fight for justice than those who fight to maintain an unjust status quo, where more people committed to nonviolence out-organize and challenge those who saturate our nation with guns and destabilize or destroy our nations with war. Together we can build a nation that will be able to pass the test of the God of history, asking whether we gave food to the hungry and clothes to the naked and cared for the sick and visited those in prison, gave water to the thirsty, and saw and helped the least of these, my children. 79 years ago, a black baby boy named Martin Luther King Jr. was born in America. He grew up to become our greatest 20th century American prophet. He was killed in 1968 as he called on us to end our warring and greedy ways, the poverty staining our wealthy land, and to confront the triple evils of militarism, materialism, and racism that would lead to our destruction. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, his good friend, believed that the whole future of America depended on his impact and influence. And I agree, and I wanted to write a letter to him and to our leaders and to us citizens, reporting to him on our progress and what remains to be done. But also write letters to all of us, because we face great challenges, although we have made great progress. And I think that it is time for us to move forward to realize America's and Dr. King's great dream. The day that he was assassinated, he called his mother from Memphis to give her his next Sunday sermon title, and that was Why America May Go to Hell. And he said that America is going to hell if we don't use her vast resources to end poverty and make it possible for all of God's children to have the basic necessities of life. And I wanted to share, as I go into my deep concern about what is happening to America's sixth child in the cradle-to-prison pipeline, a very moving poem that Ann Weems, whom I recommend to you, W-E-E-M-S, wrote, along with many other moving things, but it really touched my heartstrings. It's called Greenless Child. Ann writes, I watched her go uncelebrated into the second grade, a greenless child, gray among the orange and yellow, attached too much to corners and to other people's sunshine. She colors the rainbow brown and leaves balloons unopened in their packages. Oh, who will touch this greenless child? Who will plant alleluias in her heart and send her dancing into all the colors of God? Or will she be left like an unwrapped package on the kitchen table, too dull for anyone to take the trouble? Does God think that we are her keeper? Well, imagine God visiting our very wealthy family blessed with six children. Five of them have enough to eat and comfortable rooms in which to sleep. One does not. She's often hungry and cold, and on some nights she has to sleep on the streets or in a shelter or even be taken away from her neglectful family and placed in foster care or group homes with strangers. Imagine this rich family giving five of its children nourishing meals three times a day, snacks to fuel, boundless energy, but sending the sixth child from the table into school hungry, with only one or two meals and never the dessert the other children enjoy. Imagine this very wealthy family making sure five of its children get all their shots, regular health checkups before they get sick, and immediate access to health care when illness strikes, but ignoring the sixth child, who is plagued by chronic respiratory infections and painful toothaches, which sometimes abscess and kill for lack of a doctor or a dentist. Imagine this family sending five of their children to good, stimulating preschools and making sure they have music and swimming lessons after school, but sending the sixth child to unsafe daycare with untrained caregivers responsible for too many children, or leaving her occasionally with an accommodating relative or neighbor or older sibling or even all alone. Imagine five of the children living in homes with books and families able to read to most of their children every night, but leaving the other child unread to, untalked and unsung to, unhugged or propped before a television screen or a video game that feeds him violence and sex and racially and gender-charged messages, intellectual pablum, interrupted only by ceaseless ads for material things beyond the child's grasp. Imagine this family sending some of their children to high-quality schools and safe neighborhoods with enough books and computers and laboratories and science equipment and well-prepared teachers, and sending the sixth child to a crumbling school building with peeling ceilings and leaks and lead in the paint and asbestos, and old, old books and not enough of them, and teachers untrained in the subjects they teach and with low expectations that all children can learn, especially the sixth child. Imagine most of the family's children being excited about learning and looking forward to finishing high school, going to college, and getting a job, and the sixth child falling further and further behind grade level, not being able to read, wanting to drop out of school, and being suspended and expelled at younger and younger ages because no one has taught him to read and compute or diagnosed his attention deficit disorder or treated his health and mental health problems and helped him keep up with his peers. Imagine five of the children engaged in sports and music and arts and after school and summer programs and camps and enrichment efforts, and the sixth child hanging out with peers or going home alone because mom and dad are working or are in prison or have run away from their parenting responsibilities and escaped in drugs and alcohol, leaving him alone or on the streets during idle non-school hours and weeks and months, at risk of being sucked into illegal activities and the prison pipeline or killed in our gun-saturated nation. Well, this is our American family today, where one in six of all of our children lives in poverty in the richest nation on earth, more than 40% in extreme poverty, and we've had an increase of 200,000 children in extreme poverty over the last year, and that was before this economic downturn. It is not a stable, healthy, economically sensible, or just family. Our failure to invest in all of our children before they get sick or drop out of school and get into trouble is morally indefensible and extremely costly. Every year we let 13 million children live in poverty, cost $500 billion in lost productivity and the cost of crime and health denial. You cannot hurt others, especially children, without consequences. And contrary to popular stereotypes, America's sixth child is more than twice as likely to live in a working family than to be on welfare, is more likely to be white than black or Latina, and is more likely to live in a rural or suburban area than in an inner city. But black and Hispanic children are at far greater risk of being poor and of entering the cradle-to-prison pipeline. The most dangerous place for a child to struggle to grow up in America is at that intersection of race and poverty. Racial disparities still permeate all the major American institutions that shape the life chances of millions of children. Undergirded by poverty, these disparities are putting countless children at risk of incarceration and funneling hundreds of thousands of them every year into a pipeline to prison and often to death, derailing their chances for reaching successful adulthood. Incarceration is becoming the new American apartheid, and poor children of color are the fodder. And as leaders and as citizens, as parents, as faith leaders, as educators, we must all see, understand, and sound the alarm about the threat to American unity and community. Act to stop this growing criminalization of children at younger and younger ages and tackle the unjust treatment of minority youths and adults in the juvenile and adult criminal justice systems with urgency and persistence. The failure to act now will, and I believe, reverse the hard-earned racial and social progress that Dr. King and so many others died and sacrificed for, and weaken our future capacity to lead and the credibility of America's dream. So all leaders in all sectors must call
for investment in all children from birth through their successful transition to adulthood, remembering Frederick Douglass's correct observation that it is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. So many poor babies in rich America enter the world with multiple strikes against them, born without prenatal care, at low birth weight, and to a teen, poor, or poorly educated single mother and absent father. At crucial points in their development after birth until adulthood, more risk pile on, making a successful transition to productive adulthood significantly less likely, and contact and involvement in the criminal justice system significantly more likely, since children of color always have been disproportionately poor. Their odds of incarceration as adults greatly exceed that of white children. Black children are more than 3 times as likely as white children to be poor and are almost 6 times as likely as white children to be incarcerated. A black boy today who is 7 years old has a 1 in 3 lifetime risk of going to prison. A Latino boy, a 1 in 6 chance. A black girl and a white boy, a 1 in 17 chance of going to prison in their lifetime. And the past continues to strangle the present and the future. Children with an incarcerated parent are more likely to become incarcerated. Black children are nearly 9 times and Latino children 3 times as likely as white children to have an incarcerated parent. Blacks constitute 1/3 and Latinos 1/5 of our imprisoned population. And 1 in 3 black men, 20 to 29 years old, who need to be fathers in the home is under congressional supervision or control. And we all know that we now have the dubious distinction of being the world's largest jailer. We have over 2 million people in prison, 2.3 million people in prison or jail, but we have over 7 million people in jail or on probation or on parole. And unjust drug sentencing policies have greatly escalated the incarceration of minority adults and youth. And 2/3 of all those who are in prison, and 2/3 of those who are in juvenile detention, are not there for violent offenses. They're there for nonviolent offenses. And we need to really begin to look at our policies. These are community tragedies. But this is an impending national catastrophe that affects every one of us. They are ripping apart millions of families, these numbers, stripping away the right to vote for many, and blocking the chance to get a job to support a family, so it becomes a revolving door. They decrease public security as more and more prisoners reenter society without the means to legally support themselves, and they drain taxpayer dollars as increasing billions are spent on massive incarceration of young and old, and we need to change course. I can't think of a dumber investment policy than to see our state spending on average 3 times more per prisoner than per public school pupil, and California spends almost 4 times as much. And in many ways, the increase in incarceration costs is exceeding the increase in higher education spending. I mean, this is crazy investment policy. I'm getting older. I don't like to admit it, but I want to make sure that they're out producing jobs and that we are producing productive workers who are going to keep our Social Security system strong and be paying for us rather than us paying to keep them in very costly jails. So I think we need to come together to have a paradigm change away from punishment as a first resort into prevention and early intervention. And we need to close up these feeder systems, and I invite you to join us in February, on the 25th and 26th of February. We're going to have a meeting on the Cradle to Prison Pipeline in California, but nationally showing best practices, because the Cradle to Prison Pipeline is not an act of God. These are a set of human choices that we have made, and they're immoral in my view, they're political and they're economic, and they can and must be changed with strong leadership at the community level, the private sector, in the political level, and in our culture. Now, no single sector or group can change these child and nation-threatening crises alone, but all of us can together. And as leaders, we must demand that our leaders call us to the table and use their bully pulpits, and we must begin to convene and call people together to really begin to look at what is happening to our children and see how we can intervene to save lives and save families and save taxpayer money and save our nation's aspiration to be a fair society. Now, what can we do? I think that the first thing we can do is to just do our homework and to see what is happening and to look at what is happening in our communities. I don't know how many of you have ever been in juvenile detention facilities or into the prison systems and to see the mothers and the fathers there, but to see the young children there. I was in Los Angeles 3 weeks ago and went out to a youth camp to a book group of young people, mostly Latino and black, and when I asked them what their greatest fear was, to a person, they all just assumed they were going to die very shortly. One little boy said, maybe 17 years old, these were children 15 to 19, that he was worried about how his mother would react when he was dead. They're totally preoccupied with death rather than life, and they're totally without hope, and what a terrible thing to do, to take away the hope and the dreams of a child and to not give them a sense of basic safety and adult protection. So we need to go in and see these children, these institutions, and see what we're doing. But we all need to confront, and I hope you will look at this chapter on the cradle, look at the facts, and begin to sort of look at leaders and confront our leaders about whether we can't do better. And we know what to do. We need to vote for people who are going to vote to invest in children early. And one of the first things I hope we will all do, because we're at, I think, a nation-transforming time, and we're going to be making some very fundamental choices. Go to the Children's Defense Fund voting record. Go look at our voting record on the website. And look at how the people who are asking for your votes at the Congress level, your representatives and your senators and your president, look at what they do, because our political leaders in both parties love to kiss children in election campaigns. And then they go into the legislature and they close their doors, and children are not standing outside those doors to lobby. And so they tend to vote against children. But we do a nonpartisan voting record, and we have a list of how your California senators and congressmen voted on both sides. And for those who pass and have 100%, thank them very much. For those who flunk, please keep them at home. We don't need them in Washington. Children have enough problems. And I hope you will look at the voting records, because this is one of the rare times where we have 3 out of the 4 candidates for president with a long voting record. We don't have very much of a record on Governor Palin, but we do know that Barack Obama, who is in his 4th year in the Senate, and we don't have this year's because the Congress is not yet adjourned, but he had for his first 2 years 100% on Children's Defense Fund's voting record. Last year he had 60%, which is, we count absenteeisms, absentee votes against you, but his cumulative score over the 3 years is 87%. And we know what his proposals are on health care and early childhood development, and you should look at their platforms and look at what they're saying they're going to do, and look at what they're saying about education, look at what they're saying on tax relief for those in the middle and at the bottom, and then see how you're going to feel about what your choices are going to be. Joe Biden has been in the Senate since 1981, and he has had very many years when he's had 90 or 100%, and in the years when he was running for office, he's dipped too, but his cumulative average since 1981 on our voting records is 81%. We have had Senator McCain has been in the Senate since 1983, and his cumulative voting record has been less than 28%. I give my rounded out at 28%. And last year, he had a voting record on our children's voting card of 10%. And the good news about that, and it was the lowest in the Senate, the 10%, the good news about that he voted for the first time in many years to increase the minimum wage, which hadn't been increased in 10 years, because he'd voted against it previously 3 or 4 times. But he also voted twice to not overrule the veto, or override the veto of President Bush for an inadequate child health bill. It was so inadequate, the state children's health bill, the CHIP program, that we didn't really want it because it would have only covered 4 or 5 million children and not done any reforms in the benefit package. And we want all children covered because we don't think God made two classes of children. And we didn't approve of leaving 5 million children out. But he voted twice not to even vote for that very watered-down bill. And so I just hope, look and study the record, look at the tax positions, look at how they choose to spend money, look at what they've done on education and early childhood, and then vote what you think is going to be the best set of choices for our children. Now, we heard over and over again the double standards, which is why we have to raise a ruckus, build a movement, that they couldn't afford as we put in a bill to cover all children and all pregnant mothers last year, called the All Healthy Children's Act. And they give them all the same benefits, but it would have cost $70 billion over 5 years to cover all of our children, all of our pregnant women. And, you know, they said we couldn't find it, we couldn't afford it. And look at how quick they found $700 billion to bail out the reckless scoundrels who have ended, you know, our economic stability. And I don't think we've seen the bottom of that. So next year, well, I do favor universal health care for everybody, and I do hope that you will ask all of your representatives how they're going to vote on covering America's people. It's just outrageous that everybody does not have health care, and it's out. And you're going to see that problem increased as more jobs are lost and more homes are lost. And what are people supposed to do? We should have a health safety net. And I do hope we can really push our leaders to do health care for all. But if we can't get health care for everybody, we've been debating it about 6 decades now. I hope that we will also, as adults, say we should at least begin with all children first and all pregnant women, because children can't wait. They have only one childhood. They need their attention deficit disorders diagnosed right now before we expel them and suspend them from school. They need to be able to see the blackboard and hear the teacher right now. They need to get the investments they need to be able to perform well in school so that they are not acting out. And we're not seeing school officials, as we are seeing all over this country, expel or suspend and even call police officers on the grounds to arrest children 6 and 7 and 8 years old for acting out. Some of us adults have lost our minds when you think it requires 3 police officers with handcuffs on ankles and wrists to come and take a 6-year-old off the school grounds in Florida. I think we can do better, and we really need to hear the cries of children seeking attention and really begin to keep them in school. But the second thing we've got to do is to invest in early childhood development. If we can get them onto the earth in a more level playing field through health care and family support systems and home visiting programs, and most parents want to do the best thing. You can't teach what you don't know, though. And we really need to see that we get these children into care, provide them support, keep them out of that child welfare system. And again, poor children are at much greater risk. They are 22 times more likely to be neglected or abused and to move into the child welfare system. And we also have the spectacle of thousands of parents giving up their children, judging themselves neglected and abused, in order to get them mental health coverage, which they cannot get at the community level. And what a horrible thing. And so we've got all these children sitting up in juvenile detention facilities in order to get mental health care at the cost of thousands of dollars of taxpayer costs. This makes no sense. So health care, but then early childhood development. We know about early brain development and the importance of the first 3 years of life. There are wonderful programs that can respond to this. And yet early Head Start of high quality reaches only 3% of the eligible children. And so we lay out a set of things that we need to get done in policy to close off the entry points into the prison pipeline and put children on a trajectory of success. And we know that achievement in school begins at birth and in the early years with good investments. And so we all need to have a high-quality early childhood system, child care for working parents. And we know that children are in school only 17% of the school year, of the year, of their time. And so we really also have to have very high-quality after-school programs and summer enrichment programs. The gangs and the drug dealers are available 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. We've got to open up these congregations. We've got to open up the doors of our community institutions and our schools and have children have a safe haven from the streets. And I'm going to come back and talk very briefly about Freedom Schools, which is a model that I'm very proud of, that is run by college-age students with a high degree of parental involvement. They have to come every week. This for children 5 to 15, some of the scenes from the video or from our freedom schools. We have 138 of them, and we want to have some here in Marin County. We make learning fun. There's a very rigorous integrated reading curriculum, and the books are terrific. And we find when children, we said we want to teach children a love of learning. And they love having the teacher mentors from the counties where they grew up. They don't need Michael Jordan as a role model. They need somebody who grew up in the same area, went through a lot of the same problems, that are coming to give back. And the energy of these college teacher mentors, and many of them are now going into teaching. And I'm very pleased a third of them, or about a third to a half in most years, are black males or Latino males, and they want to give back. But these are young people that they can identify with. We train them down at the Alex Haley Forum, which is our Leadership and Spiritual Renewal Center near Knoxville, Tennessee. And we engage parents in weekly workshops. They all have to engage in service, and they all have to feel empowered and go out and be a good citizen and engage in a civic action. And there's nothing like watching the face of a senator when 300 or 400 children walk in their offices asking why they're not getting health care or why they're not going to do something about guns. But the point is that children are not citizens in waiting. They are citizens now, and we have the example of the incredibly empowered children, whether it's Little Ruby Bridges or the Little Rock Nine or the Birmingham children who went to jail when no adults had the courage to do so, when Dr. King issued the call, and which led through their witness and sacrifice, standing up to fire hoses and to police dogs, to the voting, to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So children need to be empowered from the beginning, and they really will step up to the plate. We were very careful not to say that we were going to increase reading scores, but it turns out, and we have 19 freedom schools in Kansas City, that in our first national evaluation of those freedom schools over a three-year period, if you stay in those freedom schools for 6 weeks, we've stopped summer learning loss, let's put it that way, but if you stay in the freedom schools for 6 weeks over three summers, we found in Kansas City that our kids were picking up 2.2 years in reading gains. But they love freedom schools, and the point is that school should be about children and empowering children and making them feel that they're the center of things. And in too many of our child-serving institutions, children are beside the point. It's the convenience of adults. So we're encouraging as many people as we know to go into service for children, as many people as we know to go into teaching for children, but we say teaching is a mission, not a job. And if you don't love all children, please get out of the classroom, because even if you have the best qualifications and the best classrooms and the fanciest buildings, if you don't respect and expect all children to learn, that you will do harm. So we need to make sure that we are really giving every child a first-rate education. The four figures that worry me so much, in addition to the prison pipeline ones, are the fact that a child drops out of school every 10 seconds of a school day. These are children of all races. That a majority, 65%, in 12th grade, but a majority of all children of all racial and income groups cannot read at grade level in 4th, 8th, and 12th grade, and that 80%, over 80% of black and Hispanic children cannot read at grade level, and many of them have already dropped out by 12th grade, and over 90% cannot compute at grade level in 12th grade. What does a child do if you can't read in this globalizing economy? How is a child to get a job and to be anything other than someone who functions beneath the law if they can't compute at the most basic levels? How are our children going to compete with Chinese children and European children and Indian children in this competitive arena? And so these are the figures that are going to really topple America. And I can't figure out where is our lack of will and our lack of skill. I believe this country can do anything it puts its mind to. And we have sent spaceships to Mars and men and women to the moon. We've cracked a genetic code. We mine trillions of dollars through a tiny microchip. And yet we can't figure out how to teach children how to read in fourth grade and in eighth grade. So we really need a reckoning here about what's important. I don't think we have a money problem in America. We have a profound values problem. We don't have a children's problem. We have a profound adult problem and a commitment problem. And it is time to change our moral compass and really begin to get our children understanding that we're going to be there. So please, let's vote. Please, let's begin to make choices about professions that are going to enhance America's future and enhance the community around us. Please let's make commitments to try to begin to reweave the fabric of family and community. That will be a good buffer for children despite the external messages of the culture that glorify so many extrinsic things that are not of great importance. And let's see if we can rescue the spiritual baby from the bathwater of American materialism and put our children back on a path to moral purpose if we can. I hope that we will celebrate the resilience and the strengths of our children. One of the programs we started in Los Angeles was a program called Beat the Odds, where we take high school juniors who have undergone homelessness and incarceration and neglect and abuse, but one teacher or a guidance counselor or a grandma or a church person saw something in this child and reached out and gave them a lifeline of hope, and these children are making it. And they have. We give them scholarships and computers and a shopping spree, and we try to put them on a ladder of leadership. And now we've got maybe 650 or 700 in our pool of young people who beat the odds, and you should see them. They're lawyers and they're doctors and they're Peace Corps volunteers and they're giving back. We don't have a right to give up on any child. I think that every child is sacred, and if you give them high expectations and a hand, they will grab it. They will live up or down to our expectations. So I hope we'll celebrate our children's strengths, and I hope we can begin to get Beat the Odds programs here in Marin County, and I invite you to come down to Los Angeles on December 4th and see what a Beat the Odds program can do. And I hope that privileged children can see the strengths of these children who are dealing with odds that many of us would never be able to survive. But let's begin to come together. In the book, I try to write a letter to parents because I think parenting is the most important and hard job in the world, and we don't support and prepare people for it. But we really do need to step up and take family life seriously again, and we need to have policies and community supports that help parents be the good parents that most want to be. Right? But parents can't raise children by themselves. If the jobs move away, if the economy is in downturn, if they're working two or three jobs and can't get health care, we need better public policies and community support programs. And children should not be punished for the parents that they did not choose. And so we should get our clear thinking going here. And whether or not we like these children or like these parents, it is still in our self-interest to invest in making them productive rather than the opposite. Secondly, I do hope that we will be better neighbors and that we will be a part of a broad community. We were community property when I was growing up as a child in the segregated South. It told me I wasn't worth much, but I didn't believe it because my parents said it wasn't so, my preacher said it wasn't so, my community elders said it wasn't so, and so we knew it wasn't so. But that sense of community, of having adults who felt the sense of responsibility for you, I think has waned, and it needs to be rejuvenated because, again, children need community. I talk to teachers and educators who are so important. Talk to faith leaders because the church and mosque and we need and all faiths need to remember their tenets and really reach out and become a voice for the poor and for the weak and for the vulnerable. But too often, too many of our people of faith today are puppets rather than challengers of the culture. And I hope that we can regain our prophetic voice. And there are letters to citizens, and that's my last point that I want to make. And while we are at a transforming time, I don't know what is going to happen next week at every level, but I just hope everybody will get out and vote and take your children to vote so that they see you not as bystanders, but see that this is a part of citizenship. I take my babies from the time they were just little fellas, but I think they should see parents engaged in taking responsibility for our democracy, and I hope we will go out and vote, but then I hope we will not think that a miracle's got to happen, because if we citizens don't organize a citizens' movement, and a lot of people have been waiting for another Dr. King or waiting for a new charismatic leader to come in and solve all of our problems, it's not going to happen, folks. Dr. King understood that the movement made him. It took Mrs. Parks sitting down to make the Montgomery community stand up and Dr. King stand up, and that plan, and there are a number of citizens who had been waiting and for the right spark that Mrs. Parks represented, who had organized to take advantage and to be able to challenge the segregation in Montgomery. But if we don't organize and be ready with an agenda for children, with the house having been robbed and it's going to get worse, children are going to get lost in the shuffle. And so we've got to begin right now on the day after to say we've got to have health care for every child, we've got to end child poverty, we've got to have an agenda here that really begins to reverse the trend of taking from the weak to give to the strong. And so we need to organize a citizens movement. And so I hope you will look at the chapter on citizens. I hope women and grandmothers especially will look at what we can do. I love men. I have a great husband. I had a great father. I have three great sons. I finally got two granddaughters, too. But I think it's time for women's voices as well, and grandma's and grandpa's voices to be heard. We're just going to have to raise a ruckus if we're going to change the direction of the nation, and we must change the direction of the nation. And I hope we will understand that we can do it, and we must do it. Let me just end with a quote from Albert Camus, which always moves me. He was speaking at a Dominican monastery in 1948, and he said, "Perhaps we cannot prevent this world from being a world in which children are tortured, but we can reduce the number of tortured children." And he described our responsibility as human beings, if not to reduce evil, at least not to add to it, and to refuse to consent to conditions which torture innocence. "I continue," he said, "to struggle against this universe in which children suffer and die, and so must each of us. What the world," he says, "expects of Christians is that Christians should speak out loud and clear, that they should get away from abstractions and confront the blood-stained face of history that has been taken on today. The grouping we need is a grouping of men, and I would add women, resolved to speak out clearly and to pay up personally." I do hope that everyone here will begin to speak out clearly and be willing to sacrifice personally to see that the children that we have as our legacy will get what they need to carry our country and our world into a new century, that they will be grounded in love and rooted in values of a nation that honors those values by what we do in investing in the lives of the young and the weak. So thank you for letting me come, and let's build our movement. Thank you.
Ms. Edelman has graciously said that she would answer some questions. So if anyone has a question, please feel free to come up to the mic and we'll see if we can answer. I see somebody coming right now.
My name is Peter Gisella. Sorry I got here late. But back in 92, I learned about service learning, and I'm sure you alluded to that. But I connected to that very strongly because I've been interested in a National Youth Service Program for over 30 years. Now, my question for you is, what is the catalyst that could cut those strings, as you talked about, regarding being a puppet? The particular bill that was in the Congress that I've been trying to educate leaders like you would have replaced the Selective Service Program with a National Youth Service Program, but a volunteer one, but with an enhanced registration where males and females would register at 17, be encouraged to debate and talk about their roles as participants in the civic engagement we call democracy, and then at 18 indicate yes, no, or maybe towards participating something in their community, in their state, in the nation, in the planet, Peace Corps, or in the military service. And service learning in their community could be a very powerful participation where they go into the earlier schools and help children learn to read. But my frustration is I can't get any leaders to go on record saying this is a valid idea worth discussing.
Have you looked at the Obama proposals?
I have, and he has talked about very vigorously enhancing AmeriCorps, enhancing the Peace Corps, challenging youth through his talks. But this is a catalyst that would challenge all youth to think about it.
I think you will find, and I'm very much in favor of service learning in a wide variety of settings, but I think you will find, and let me just say I am nonpartisan here, but at least there are some thoughtful proposals that go beyond just what you describe, and he's really very much committed, because I've just been looking at the section on disconnected youth, But he's really trying to encourage a wide variety of engagements of all of us, and particularly young people, I think, in service opportunities that would be both civilian and very broad-based, and it would cut across all the needs of our country's infrastructure, including if there's going to be an energy policy, where do young people come into that? If we need to bolster schools and encourage more people to go into teaching, how do you reward that? So I think that you will see forthcoming a very broad and comprehensive commitment to that, and there's an awful lot of momentum to try to move in a very major direction in that. And because young people have been so engaged in this campaign, I think that there's a need to really reward and offer structures for advocacy and for service. So I think you will probably not be disappointed. I don't know the specifics of the kind of program you propose, but I think you will find that there will be very significant comprehensive programs for service learning and beyond to try to fill in some of the gaps of areas of need. And I hope that that's one of the things that all of us will speak very strongly about. We just need to have a call for all of us to come together to rebuild our nation and our fraying infrastructure. And we really need to give our disconnected youth as well as our privileged youth opportunities to serve. And I think you will see a number of incentives to encourage people to go into undersubscribed professions. But I hope you won't be disappointed if we end up with that new leader next week.
As a tall child, I thank you for your remarks, and I hope my perspective is respected and considered.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Yes.
Good evening. My name is Didosio Habi, and as I sat there listening to the information that you provided, it was so overwhelming because I'm sure many people here have heard some of the same things that you've so eloquently stated. The question I have for you is, in your opinion, what is it within the individual that causes him or her to become complacent and inactive? When we know that these are realities that we must address, what is it? What has become of us, or what is it within us that has caused us to just sit still?
Well, I think about that a whole lot. And I wish if I knew the answer to that completely, but I think that we've got to combat it. I think that we have this big distinction about between our children and other people's children. Let me just speak at it from a children's perspective. And we have a very individualistic and privatistic view of who's responsible for children than just the family, even though the reality is that it requires far more. And we have a history of, and again, looking at the children's movement, that has intertwined our views about children and worthiness and the poor with race. And I think we've been gradually trying to disentangle these kinds of things. And we have a profound distrust of government in many ways that has been fueled and fed, even though it is our common way of trying to solve our common problems. And we've also had over the last decades a growing, and Dr. King, sense of individualism, and that this is all about me and not about me in any sense of responsibility for community. And I think a lot of people, the signals of our culture have been so, I think, corrosive in what they have told us is important and what it is that we should be valuing, and most of that has been outside, and we tend to therefore blame the victim. If somebody's not making it, is not working, it's their fault. If even a two-month-old baby doesn't have any bootstraps to pull up, it's just been a very hard thing to kind of, you know, capture that sense of community and to overcome the inconvenience of making people act, and we have not had leaders that called us to sacrifice. And I think we have not had faith leaders that call us and remind us of the Judeo-Christian tradition and of all great traditions in our faith. It says we're about our brothers, we're indeed our brothers and our sisters' keeper. And so I think it's a very big dearth of moral leadership at all levels. But on the other hand, as I say that, I want to just say that there are many people doing wonderful things all over this country, and it's kind of contagious. And I find that when you do issue a call and provide an example, that children will follow. And so I hope that in the book I try to lay out what everybody should be doing. And I think that, you know, there are so many small things we can do in terms of just parenting. We just start at home and take the responsibility for the children in our home and begin to reestablish daily rituals. If we just smile at the children in our neighborhood, and we often don't. And if you're in a classroom, just to affirm a child and to compliment them on things that are done well. But we've just gotten out of the habit, I think, of too many of us, of sensing that we are responsible for everybody else. I kind of just grew up in an era, and I think we need to try to reestablish some of that, where I feel so blessed to have people who are people of faith, but who absolutely try to live that faith. They didn't have a whole lot. And there was always that sense that you had a little, but you could always share it. And if you saw a need, you tried to respond. And that's a part of what we're trying to re-inculcate in our young people down at Alice Haley Farm. And I must say, they come and they're getting it. And they do want to be useful. They do want to respond to their community. And we adults, through service opportunities, through our examples, through the kinds of atmosphere we create in our universities and in our classrooms, I think can begin to turn around and counter the kind of selfishness and excessive individualism that Dr. King warned us against. And it's about leadership. I mean, it's about being called to something that's our high self. And I think that people really do want to be appealed to be greater than they are and to build something better than we have. And so I'm hopeful that we're going to be in a new era of a call to sacrifice and a call to service and a call to leadership, and that we will respond. And I've just seen how leaders at the community level can perform miracles, and what one person can do in changing the tone in a classroom or in a school or in a community or in a church. And so we've just got to encourage and affirm that. But I just think that a lot of wonderful things are going on. We've just got to translate it and focus it and connect it. And I think we're seeing some of that excitement in this year. But then if that excitement can be carried over into trying to really foster a new sense of how we relate to each other. And I think one of my other pet things is I just think we've got to really have serious nonviolence and conflict resolution training in this world. And we need to kind of get back to just the basic respect for human life and for each other. And we're not teaching our children that. And the culture, again, it makes it so much harder for parents and for individuals to do it. But I hope we can begin to have a new national conversation, because I think we've gone about as far as we can go without self-destruction. And I think that the precarity the nuclear precarity, I mean, have leaders sitting here talking about how we can build more effective nuclear weapons is just about the craziest thing I ever thought of. I mean, and in this place where you've got rogue nations and rogue terrorists, so I just think that we've got to come back from the brink, and that requires leadership, but it requires leadership from all of us and a new level of conversation. But I think that there's a readiness among many of us to begin to engage in that. And it doesn't take everybody. It just takes a few people to set a tone. I was very struck. I'm back in my home county, my hometown, which is 7,000 people, and I look at it's as desolate in some ways in our rural areas, and the two biggest things in my rural county are the prisons. And there are more things for children to do inside the prisons or young people do in the prisons. There's a daycare center in the prisons. There are not very many daycare centers outside the prisons. And there's stuff that goes on. But then I realized back in the hard segregated days, it was really 5 or 6 or 7 preachers and teachers who set the tone and the standards for our community. And we just need to find that remnant of people who are going to stand up and say, this is what is right. And begin to move and take responsibility of reweaving family and reweaving community and saying that is not good, and turning off the TV set and stop buying the products of people who are pushing all of this stuff out on us. So I would not be discouraged. I would not be discouraged.
And I'm not. I'm not at all. This is actually inspiring to me, and I appreciate it.
Well, I tell the story often. I told it last night to a group. I wear Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman with me. I usually wear them beneath my clothes. I brought them out this year to give me extra courage. But these were women who did not, these were both illiterate slave women, but they were brilliant and wise, and they could not, in an impossible time, stand second-class treatment of women, and they could not stand slavery, and they did not wait for the Emancipation Proclamation or for politicians to come and free them. And when Harriet Tubman got over the border from Maryland into freedom, she was lonely, and she decided she had to go back and bring 300 people with her. And she just you lift as you climb, and you free yourself in order to free others. But Sojourner was very eloquent, and one of my favorite Sojourner stories, which I tell a lot, is one day when she was being heckled about speaking out against slavery, which was viewed as impossible at the time she was doing it, and she got heckled by an old white man who said to her, "Old slave woman, don't care more about you than for an old flea bite. You're anti-slavery talking for an old flea bite," and she snapped at him and said, "That's all right, the Lord willing, I'm going to keep you scratching." And very often, and I remember her a lot, because we all like to be big dogs and to make big changes, and we do need big changes. But I've watched the Flea Corps for Children grow over the last 35 years. And enough of us, if we have strategic fleas biting for justice, we can make the biggest dog uncomfortable. And I think that we should just, each of us saying, you know, we don't want to make those emails. If when we went to all these prayer meetings and Bible studies, if we say, if 10% of us in these Bible studies say we're going to email after the Bible study to say, how about health care for children? It would cause a revolution. If they got 10 letters from you all every week saying health care for children, then when we won that, we go say child care for children. And then we got that, we'll go to the next one. But just be a strategic flea. And enough of us, if they flick us off, and enough to keep coming back. So try to be a flea.
Thank you.
Be a flea with your boat and your calls.
We actually don't have any more time for questions. Let's have a rousing applause and thank you for Marion Wright Edelman. And I would like to ask Elaine Petrucelli to come to the podium and tell us our next steps.
Thank you, Elaine. Our next step is to get our book signed and to meet Marion Wright Edelman. She will be up here. We'll be fixing up the table. If you don't mind coming up, I think we'll go through the center aisle and then around, and I'll help you get Post-its. And if you're like me and you've decided you have to buy a copy for everyone you love, my colleagues are in the back helping to make that happen.
There you go, folks. Radio.Dominican.edu. Another live broadcast, this time from Guzman Hall here at Dominican University of California. A pleasure to have brought to you Marion Wright Edelman live worldwide on the 27th of October, 2008, from Dominican University of California. This broadcast will be available for podcasts or downloading in about 24 hours from now. Should you like to grab it, keep it forever? On behalf of everyone at the Communications Department, Stuart Horn signing off from tonight's broadcast here at Guzman Lecture Hall at Dominican University of California, broadcasting live worldwide 24 hours a day on radio.dominican.edu.